This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on www.prn.fm. This radio presentation replays my weekly TV show, Refounding America with Peter R. Breggin, MD, which can be watched on Brighteon.tv, and it's available on Roku. I interview guests who are heroes and pioneers in confronting the global predators who are behind COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccines, corrupt public health and medicine, global warming, the Great Reset, and other justifications for destroying the Western democracies. They are stealing our countries, our freedoms, our dignity and hope, and our jobs and our savings. For documentation of this worldwide tragedy, read our new book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, by Peter and Ginger Breggin. Together, my guests and I explore what is happening and what we each can do to refound America and inspire the world. Thank you for your courage in facing these challenges and standing up for liberty. Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Hello, hello, my wonderful, wonderful audience on TV and on radio. It's such a pleasure to be here as always, keeping me in touch with life, giving me a chance to do things that matter, help you understand what's going on in the world. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Christopher Shoemaker, and I'll tell you more about him. But one of the things that we're going to have the opportunity to do is to really learn from a dedicated physician what it's felt like to be exposed to what's going on in the world today. And folks, COVID-19, the global predators, we're over 90,000 in sales. If you read the book, you'll understand what's going on better in the Ukraine. I've been astonished about how the principles of predation, global predation, are being carried out in the Ukraine. It's very complicated, but the leader of the Ukraine is very close to the global predators, and he's a part of Klaus Schwab's outfit. So interesting. It helps clarify things. See you again soon. Well, folks, you are looking at not only at Peter Breggin, whom you've seen before, but Christopher Shoemaker, Dr. Christopher Shoemaker, whom you may not have seen a lot before. He's done emergency and comprehensive care, hospital medicine across Canada. So we'll be talking some about Canada today. He has worked on rural settings, city settings. He's been in the military settings. Right now, he's basically in Ontario. And when you look at him, you can just see, you look like the doctor that I wish I'd had when I was a young man, and going to the doctor and wanting to see somebody who looks happy and pleasant and anchored. But now, so that you know some of what's coming later, I'm going to show him in public, really dynamically talking to a crowd, and he'll tell us more about that. Can we bring up the video and show the man when he puts on his cape?
Around the Ottawa area to come down and see this for yourself. Your eyes cannot be opened until you see what is here today and what they're trying to tell you at 6 o'clock. I will just end by saying thank you once again to our brave truckers. I pray that you hold the line for us. And I wish you guys all the best. Stay warm.
All right, we're not done. We have now a local physician, Dr. Shoemaker. He's from here. He's in the trenches. He's handling it. He's a brave bastard. And here he is.
Thank you, Roger. You're very kind. Hello, everybody. My full name is Chris Allen Shoemaker. I'm a general physician. I graduated from Queen's University quite a few years ago. I've been an emergency doc on and off for 25 years. I'm not doing emergency medicine right now, but recently I worked in COVID clinics. Recently I had to follow the dictums of the various colleges. Of course, we were only able to send patients home. You could take some Tylenol, go home, and if you get really sick, then go to the hospital. That's all we could do. I did my best to tell them from time to time, under my breath, that they should take some vitamin D, they should take a little zinc. I was not allowed to prescribe ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. The rest of the world has been able to benefit from those two medications. Countries like Japan, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil have been able to benefit from using it suitably. We in Canada should be allowed to prescribe, doctors should be allowed to prescribe hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. They were available, they were safe, they were researched. I prescribed hydroxychloroquine to people going to Vietnam 35 years ago. The family would travel, they'd come back, they'd take it to for 4 weeks, they're fine. If you prescribe it here, it's not for 4 weeks, it's for 5 days. 5 days that save your life. But we're not allowed to. We're just not allowed to. So listen, we're past that now. The mistakes have been made. But it's time for us to move forward. We won't make mistakes any further. Please write and let your various medical bodies know that doctors, like these people here, these wonderful people, doctors should be allowed to prescribe medicines if their patients want it.
Dr. Christopher Shoemaker, thank you for being brave, for being a part of the freedom movement. Tell us about the setting, what it was like for you.
Oh, that's the first word. It was minus 15 centigrade a lot of the time, maybe 5 degrees Fahrenheit when these speeches were being made. We were darn cold up there, and so was our audience. But everyone was warm to the fact that we were wanting to share and exchange information. We recognize that the people, the truckers, and they're not just truckers, they're regular folks. These regular folks were coming to state. We have our concerns about the safety issues with the vaccine. We've made familial decisions to defer because we think it's appropriate for our family. And that was essentially what led to the trucker conference.
Have you done many of those? Was that one of your first? When did that take place?
Oh, that speech there was one of three that I gave in Ottawa during January and February of this year.
Were you frightened in any way being there? I imagine you felt comforted with all the great people around you.
Yes, that was a factor. As the 3 weeks went by, one felt increasingly comforted by the well-meaning folks who were indeed there for each other. I had some singular interviews that were quieter, so I would say just in a hotel room with an interviewer as opposed to the stage work, but both were edifying. Both were a chance to speak to the truths that I've learned through studying the research.
You know, you and I were both trained in another era, and when I went to medical school, and people may not realize this, it's important. I mean, I never imagined the FDA would actually tell me what I could do with the medication. wasn't one of the concerns of doctors in particular. If it was approved by the FDA, then we thought it had a good margin of safety. Turns out it's not always true, but certainly in those days, we mostly thought it was true. And we never cared or thought about what the National Institute of Health thought about our treatment. We didn't think about what NIAID, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, with Fauci thought about. The CDC, which is also telling us how to treat our patients, we never thought about any of those people as having any rights to tell us really anything to control medicine. And over the years, that's been eroded, not just in COVID-19. The CDC's been for several years now telling us how to prescribe pain medicines, opiates, opioids. And I don't even know of a single law that allows them to do that. Basically, the FDA gets to approve a drug for marketing, and if the drug fails, they can require more testing. If they're concerned about it, they can take it off the market. But they don't go out and say to doctors, well, you can't use it for COVID-19. So what we've been watching, as I think back to med school and our training and residency, is a phenomena of bureaucratic totalitarianism that I was never even imagined could go on. Is that the same for you, sir?
Certainly, working, say, as a hospitalist over the years, one's main task was to use only medications that were on the hospital pharmacopeia. But you thought that there was an appropriate usage of a medication that might be used mainly for depression, but could have some influence on intestinal issues as well, even though it wasn't advertised for that intestinal issue, and you had a irritable bowel and you were going to use this medication for that purpose. No one would question you're using that quote-unquote antidepressant to assist the person with irritable bowel, even though it wasn't advertised for that purpose. If it was in your good judgment and the dosage range was appropriate and it was on the medical pharmacopoeia, that's your job to decide what could or might help your patient, and you as a physician were the one to make that decision. Of course, you would have the medical board, et cetera, and your chief of staff and the pharmacy committee reviewing things like that too, but there was really never an issue. You could prescribe quote unquote off-label. You could prescribe a medication as long as it was reasonable in the circumstance and you and your patient thought it was reasonable in the circumstance. You were perfectly ethical to use it. It would be unethical not to use it.
Brought up, but that doesn't have a clinical trial or anything like that would ever come up, although sometimes maybe there would be a useful trial that would encourage us to use a drug. It was not a standard as to whether or not, in this case, if you used an antidepressant for a gut problem, because a lot of the doctors were noticing that it was helpful, or pain, antidepressant for a pain problem or a headache problem. And they actually work off the antidepressants. I've not thought about this before. They work so much better off label than they do for depression, because they do have these blunting characteristics and subduing characteristics that can give relief to various kinds of physical ailments at times. The world that most of you out there think has existed has never existed in the form that it does take. When did you start to get really concerned? What has it been like for you to be watching this? I was in on being cynical and years earlier, because I've done a lot of legal work against drug companies and product cases, and I've been I've written a lot about adverse effects that the companies don't write about or discuss and things like that. But you're just going about your business treating people. What was it like?
As a hospitalist in the emerge doc, but more recently, as a somewhat quieter activity as I get into my late 60s towards 70, I'm doing more outpatient medicine, which actually has a certain element of psychiatry care. But when the call came to work at COVID clinics and they wanted doctors who were perhaps not actively involved in emergency anymore, but certainly with experience, to come and to work in the clinic and to be helpful and to assess. And that's what I went and did for a year and a half. And I reduced significantly my outpatient psychiatry work with children, which I was doing. And because many parents didn't want to come in, they didn't want to bring their children in that era of the mask, etc. So I was happily working with colleagues. We happily did everything we were allowed to do. We, saw intercurrent illness that had nothing to do with COVID. We would have people showing up with chest pain, maybe a cough associated with it. But in fact, the reality was that they actually had a cardiac syndrome. They had an anginal type issue. We diagnosed it both clinically and in terms of an EKG assessment. And the patient would go to hospital and be assessed for their chest pain. We certainly diagnosed any of the pneumonias that were in front of us, made the determination between a lobar pneumonia, which would get standard antibiotic treatment, and one that was more reticular and viral in appearance, that we, of course, would send the patient to the hospital for COVID therapy. SpO2 testing was done in the clinic as well. But the one thing that we just weren't in a position to do, only what the country allowed us to do. And the country and our various agencies had been influenced by the World Health Organization, influenced by studies that were antithetical or oppositional to any of the generic medications being used. And so we were stuck, just as I said at the beginning, go home, take some Tylenol, and if you get really sick, you can go to the hospital. But we have nothing really specific to give you because viral illnesses don't have a specific treatment. And here's the rather strange thing about COVID. It's the first time that we've actually had a very effective medication sitting there ready to be used, and it couldn't be used. The study that showed that ivermectin was going to be the winner was actually done in 2014, 2015. An agency called DARPA, which is the United States research arm of the military, they had assessed in the mid-2010s that hydroxychloroquine would be helpful, quite helpful, they said. But the number one was ivermectin. Ivermectin would be beautifully effective against any coronavirus, and it was their strong recommendation that it be stockpiled, made available, and be the first expectant treatment for any coronavirus outbreak were it to occur like SARS-CoV-1. So bingo, we've got SARS-CoV-2, but some of the people didn't get the memo. Well, I guess they wanted to ignore the memo. That person in particular, of course, being Dr. Anthony Fauci, he had personal motivations for not wanting to have things looked at very deeply because he knew he had a certain guilt as it applied to the genesis of this infection. And if they were to start to do anything that was down the line of the antibiotic type medicine, the antiviral type medication, both for Zika and various parasites, and now clearly also for COVID, ivermectin was the complete winner, and it was completely ignored and continues to be completely ignored in many parts of the world, which are heavily dominated by WHO philosophy.
And of course, you probably didn't imagine at that point that WHO was doing the bidding of the vaccine industry and Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab, wanting to ultimately maybe even cull a population, maybe control democracy, and of course sell billions of dollars worth of vaccines. What was that, sir?
I just wanted to say that those names were unknown to me. Yeah. Didn't know Klaus popped from a hole in the ground.
I was just in my world of doing standard medicine. But I have been very appalled in the last 2 years to find so many influences stopping the proper discourse and the proper decision-making in medical lounges and in research settings to say, this is a safe medication. It has 40-year track record. It couldn't hurt you. It has 10 times the safety profile of Tylenol. If you take accidentally double or triple the dose of Tylenol that you should, you'll begin to have liver failure, and you could die of liver failure fairly quickly if you were to take 2 to 3 times the dose of Tylenol for, say, 10 days. You could take up to 10 times the dose of ivermectin accidentally and not harm yourself. It's not what we recommend. We recommend taking the right dose. It's a doctor-prescribed dosage that is correct. But if a mistake were made, the safety profile of the medicine is so tremendous. They gave the Nobel Prize for human-grade ivermectin research in 2015 to the original researchers. They'd originally researched it 40 years before. And it was such a fabulous invention, it finally got its due in 2015. Human ivermectin to treat river parasites and Zika and various other items, and with complete safety, and you keep the dosage low normal, which it should be, just a couple of milliliters under your tongue for the appropriate number of days, and it has an absolutely fantastic effect at relieving early COVID symptoms and preventing you from going on to getting true respiratory COVID.
Yeah. How did you begin to unravel this for yourself? What were some of the key things that enabled you as a man who was practicing medicine to realize it wasn't exactly in your hands anymore? And
Well, certainly, I saw interviews and read papers from many people, Dr. Zev Zelenko, Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Peter McCullough, certain European scientists as well. And there were the Barrington group, of course, had a tremendous number of physicians speaking to the fact that isolatory circumstances were not likely to be at all helpful in this regard, and that to use the appropriate antivirals would be hugely helpful, especially if applied to the most vulnerable. In terms of where I got it from, I mean, you know, the world, the internet these days, you get it from various sources, but you should keep your ears open, your heart open, and try to help people.
Yeah. You came across my website, you were telling me, at some point.
Oh, definitely, Peter. I definitely came across it about 3 months ago. Have learned so much from it and from yourself and from your guests, and so terribly impressed, and it was very kind of you to invite me.
I told Dr. Shoemaker that he gets a Happy Smile Award if he brings up how pleased he was to learn about my work.
Oh, definitely. We had some very wonderful influences on the discussion.
Yeah. It's been amazing. Have you found, as I have, that the people involved in this, you mentioned several people who become, you know, really dear friends, Zelenko, McCullough, the other people we know too. Have you found that by getting involved, you've actually, as we have, almost a new life of friendship and appreciation of other people and working together?
Oh, yes. I mean, those 3 weeks in Ottawa were tremendous. Two colleagues in particular, Canadian colleagues, Dr. Paul Alexander.
Oh, dear friend, yes.
Wonderful person, so intelligent, knew from the beginning what the right things to do were, and was being sabotaged from various directions from certain other folks. Roger Hodgkinson, of course, excellent pathological assessment of this whole situation. And Dr. Bridle, Byron Bridle, out of Guelph University. He's just a wonderfully statistically, I've learned so much from him, how that in fact, if you have a medication and it's producing anything close to 2.5% elevation in all-cause mortality, that medication never makes it to market. Or if it had briefly gotten to market, that 2 or 3% shadow rise in all-cause mortality would be enough to have that medication removed. That's why Celebrex and certain medications were removed years ago. They found out after the fact that it was causing way more harm than good. And perhaps in the second half of our interview, I'll present some statistics with you, especially with regards to children. That is frighteningly sad in terms of the risk of the vaccines to children and the elevation in their all-cause mortality because of using the vaccines.
I'm really, really glad you're going to go into it. I think that what we've done to children and are still doing in COVID-19 is the greatest child abuse in the history of the world. It's mass child abuse and probably mass murder as well. It'd be really interesting to get your data and your experience. We don't talk enough about that on the show, and it's actually been a big part of my work and Ginger's work before COVID. was talking about the harms of drugs to children and shock treatment to children and putting stimulators on their heads and stuff like that. And we haven't done enough enough on the children, I think, at this point. And we're gonna do more about it. But I think I'll be learning from you a lot in the second half as a person who's worked as a pediatrician and worked as a psychiatrist with kids. So it's going to be very interesting.
I'll hold it. It relates to that just for a moment. It just says save the children and for them, stop the jab. Children. And that's just my motto.
The other thing I want to hear about, we have just 30 seconds now, is about, you know, what kind of blowback have you gotten from anywhere, friends, family, the government, and some about Canada, just to catch people up on what's going on in Canada. I'm a little out of touch with Canada right now. We're done. We're off. We're finished with the segment. Oh, folks, welcome back to a session with a really fine physician, Dr. Christopher Shoemaker from Canada. You know, the conversation he and I are having now is pretty much how doctors used to relate to each other. I mean, you know, we were proud to be doctors, proud to know each other. We gave recognition to our professionalism. Even me, with my radical critique of drugs and, you know, taking a position that I don't think we should give any psychiatric drugs to children, for example, I rarely ran into rancor, really hostility. But around these issues, at even the hint, when I'm talking to a colleague whom I don't know well, maybe they've been my doctor for a year, but I don't know them well. And I mentioned that, I've done a book, it's critical of some of the COVID-19, and I can get a snarl. I think it's anxiety that comes up first, because anger is like the most superficial emotion. But what I'll see is the anger and the fear, and it lasts like for 10 seconds, and they get it under control, and then they go back to where they were, and they've made sure they haven't heard anything more that's going to frighten them or distress them. Have you had that experience? When we were talking before, you...
You know, I'm not such a well-known professional like yourself, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And I was working in a city where I played by the rules. I didn't bemoan anything. I was giving my Tylenol and my advice to people and assessing their pneumonias and being kind and appropriate to my colleagues as I did it. So really, we weren't really, you know, there was really not much of that kind of thing.
Right.
For me. There is a bit more now that I've come out and spoken at the Truckers Rally. And in favor of autonomy of the human body and people's own choices as to what is safe for them or safe for their child. Perhaps there's a little bit of that now, but not that much. There possibly will be more. One's own college and colleagues don't take it lightly that you're speaking that certain medications ought to have been available or perhaps should be available soon. Now that we have added informations, and in fairness to the colleges, they were only getting the information they had. It was WHO dominated, it was CDC dominated information, and everyone in the Anglo-centric world, Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the countries in Europe that relate to that, they were all following that particular line, and somehow generic medications were just to be avoided like the plague. Unfortunately, the result has been that we've had a plague and we've had actively used with it. And slowly but surely, monoclonal antibodies and other medications have come forward to be helpful in the early and intermediate stage. But quercetin hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin could all have been actively utilized during that early and intermediate stage and been highly helpful to people, given that when you use those protocols, they have an 85% success rate at preventing hospitalization, an 85% success rate at preventing ICU needs, an 85% success rate at preventing death, compared to those who do not receive those early medications. If you had any other medication that was reducing your death rate to 15%, that's 15% of what the untreated patient in the first 10 days was experiencing, people would be jumping up and down saying, my goodness, we should use that. We'll have so many fewer dead people. And that would have been the reality. But we missed the boat on that. Countries like Mexico and Brazil have not missed the boat. There are certain studies right now that a very competent doctor is reviewing from Brazil, where he saw that tremendous 85% number throughout a large, large city in Brazil. And whether used as a preventative, where it was just 2 days out of 14 that they would use the ivermectin, or used as a treatment when it was, of course, be used for 5 or 6 days. But in both instances, massive differences, 67% better in the treated group than the untreated with ivermectin group. Just, you know, if you want your grandmother to live, let her have it.
Yeah. It was very, very hard for me to, when we were writing the book and talking with many of the people you mentioned during the writing of the book, with Paul Alexander from Canada and the US, and McCullough and Leva Leeds and Zelenko, that there is a specific intention to wreck the democratic constitutional countries. I don't know how much you've looked into that, but it's openly stated by Schwab in his book, COVID-19 and the Great Reset, that what stands in the way of the globalism that all of these people are trying to create, a collectivism really of the world, whether it's under supposed capitalism or under supposed communism or progressivism, it's all the same. So it's a collectivism, a predatory collectivism. And they had to stop the US, and in particular Trump, the big surprise they didn't expect. They had to stop the patriotism. And it turns out Canadians are very patriotic. Americans, many Americans are very patriotic. But that's the opposite of globalism. It says, look, let's us take care of our country. We've got good principles. Many countries in the world have terrible principles. They have dictators. They don't believe in liberty. They have violent religious tendencies. Let's not just say that, we got to open up borders to everybody and we got to be like everybody else. Let us build our values. Let us build who we are. And that's the opposite of globalism. And the globalists don't care at all, as it turns out, about killing a great deal of people because they think there are too many people. But I could never have said this 2 years ago. It would have been a thought if I'd heard it on television or radio. I probably would have turned the station off 3 years ago if I heard anybody talking like this. But we've had to come to that conclusion. And I think pretty much most of the people that are working in the field the way we are have come to that. I'd love to go into children and let you talk for as much as you want about the issue of medication with the kids, but in particular for COVID, and particularly the vaccines. Tell us about your views now and what you've learned about vaccines and to the treatment of children in COVID.
Well, I'm learning from the research. I'm not learning from actively doing things. Children don't need medications. They 99.9998% don't even get other than slightly ill from COVID. That's just how it is. They have a tremendous immune system. And the tremendous immune system is a protection against their illness. It would have been a wonderful reservoir to allow infection to go in and out of children, give them the augmented natural immunity, and lessen the overall burden of COVID in society if children had a more normal experience, such as in Sweden, where they continued to go to schools regularly and without interruption. But a very sad bit of information came out about children in the last month and a half. On February the 2nd, the Office of National Statistics of Great Britain, which was responsible for looking at what was happening to children who they were first using the experimental vaccine with before releasing it to wider use in children. And there was 2,000 or 3,000 brave parents who let children be in the two arms of the study to take or to not take the COVID vaccine. Some of them got a saltwater injection. Some of them got a real injection of the COVID vaccines. And I'm sure they were all looking and expecting that 6, 7, 8 months later, they'd see a modest 10, 20% better looking number for the children who were treated. Well, the statistical group that followed these children, and the two groups were equally large, and they found that in the group, to their horror, that had received the double vaccination, that group had a death rate 52 times higher than the unvaccinated children.
Wow.
Here's the photo of the paper or the study. I'll hold it up to the camera for a moment. And the headline is the important thing. British children more likely to die 52 times fold following COVID shots. That was in the 10 to 14 year age group. The 17 to 19 year age group were only 4 times more likely to die, only 4 times more likely to die, 400% worse off than a non-vaccinated child. Those are the true numbers from the British Office of National Statistics. People don't go around, they're serious, they have to say the way things really are. And here's the sad, sad note. They only really discerned that information fully in the last couple of months. By that time, they'd already jumped ahead and given it to millions of children, even though these brave 4,000, 5,000 children were showing us the fact that you're 52 times more likely to have death. You're probably also 52 times more likely to have other morbidities involving your heart, your spleen, your kidneys, your ovaries, and your testes, all of which are being affected by these spike proteins. And these dear children were the canaries in the mine shaft. These children were and are giving us the evidence that the spike protein in massive amounts, which is what you get when you get the vaccine, is so dangerous to children and gives this incredible rise in their all-cause mortality. Some of these mortalities were children collapsing playing soccer. Some were not waking up, dying in their sleep. Quote unquote, undetermined. But the study showed the 52-fold increase in deaths was in the vaccinated children and no change in the normal minimal death rate of the unvaccinated children. It's a complete tragedy.
It's colossal. Frankly, I did not know about this study. It's funny how something so important can slip by in all the things we're doing. And I'm going to get a hold of that and make it available on our website as well. That's just colossal. It's murderous. It's now, what was the British government's response? If you know.
Without saying it was for this reason, it was literally 36 hours after this study came out was when Mr. Johnson canceled the mandating of vaccinations for children. He didn't say why, but it was the first mandate to be dropped. The first demandating of vaccinations was demandated for children in Britain a day and a half after this news came out. Could I just put one more thing into perspective, if I could, Dr. Brecken?
Oh, please. This is incredibly important data.
As you and I both know, even a 2 to 3% increase in all-cause mortality would be enough to withdraw a drug, a medication, or a vaccine in society before this. But I'm going to mention three other studies. One was by a chief executive officer from an Indianapolis insurance company, and he has found that in the second half of 2021, that there's a 44% increase in all-cause deaths. a 10% increase in all-cause deaths would happen only once in every 300 years. A 40% increase in all-cause deaths in adults would be like 1 in 7 billion years. That's half the length of the universe in time. It just doesn't happen. And the only way you get that surge in numbers is if you have a nuclear bomb drop on Cincinnati and Memphis and Indianapolis on the same weekend. And yet that is the increase in deaths that has been occurring in the United States, in the Midwest, and it's not being caused by COVID. COVID has a marginal half of 1% raising of death rates of the millions and millions and millions of people that die every year. It's some hidden factor. Well, there's only one big hidden factor. There were no nuclear bombs that went off in Midwestern America in the last 12 months, but there was this thing called a COVID vaccination program. And it has killed and killed and killed in huge numbers. And the embalmers know it. The morticians know it.
Yeah.
The insurance actuaries know it. Another comment on insurance actuaries is a completely different study done by Edward Dowd, who is an actuary for business investment. And he and his actuary colleagues found that in the younger group, younger than the Indianapolis group was doing, 20 to 44 years, height of their lives, there's an 84% increase in all-cause deaths in that group. It goes from 44% in the older down to 84%, up to 84% in the younger people, 20 to 44, and then it jumps to 400% increase in the 15 to 19-year-old in the British study. And then it jumps further to the 5,200% mortality all-cause increase in the vaccinated children who were 10 to 14 in the study. And I'm willing to predict with you right now, I can't say it'll be a fact, but everything is skewing up from 44 to 5,200%. So I think when they finally do study what's happening to the 5 to 9-year-olds, they're going to find that normally minuscule death rate, and it'll still be minuscule if it's 75 times higher. But you want your child to be 75 times more likely to die in the next 6 months? Get the vax. And perhaps, again, the canary in the mine shaft. If that's happening, rare deaths are being made less rare. What else is happening to their bodies? Yes. Is their cancer potentials for the next 15 years being affected? Is their splenic and renal and hepatic function being affected? Are their brains being affected? Because the German, I guess I would call them pathologists. It's a German pathologist group. I can't name the group. But they're very sophisticated, and they've been looking at the postmortems in the vaccine mortalities, and they see tremendous lymphocytic infiltration throughout spleen, kidney, heart, aorta, generative organs, that being ovaries and testes, and finally the brain. Now, small group of organs, pretty important group of organs. A pretty important group of organs all being decimated by a lymphocytic reaction to your own body being forced to produce millions and millions of spike proteins. And the people in the youngest age group are at the greatest risk because their lymphocytes and their ability to react is so strong that they actually get sicker from this vaccine than do the adults. Mm-hmm. So these are a variety of terrible but true facts. And I invite our many, many listeners to be guided somewhat by them. Thank you.
Very concise, terrifying summary. Have you written this up in a way that you and I could make available the summary of this data?
To some extent, yes, of course, we could cooperate in that, and even, I suppose, the transcript of this this interview, I guess, would be of some help, too. But yes, we could do something of that.
I would love you to send me the, some of these references, you know, we know about, but they may not be the same as yours, even about, you know, the insurance companies. And there's also a new thing we just heard that for the first time, cemeteries and graveyards are on the increase in the U.S., being built newly. I mean, this is the kind of data that's just going to keep spilling over into one or another passion. But if you would send me this, I would. I'd love to work it up, either separately or with you, and let's set it up, and we can put it on my website or anywhere else you want it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You know, you're such a sympathetic and serious doc. You're such so much what physicians are supposed to be, and to hear you recite these numbers is stunning, and I think it's just a great service to humanity. It's a great service.
Well, you know, the famous phrase, "We're all in this together," was applied to that we had to social distance and be kind to each other and do those things. But, you know, we have to be all in this together when it comes to looking at the real science, the real side effects, the real best things to do now going forward. And all I can say is, for an individual or for a parent, if you've had one shot, don't have a second. If you've had a second, don't have a third. If you've had a third, don't have a fourth. The effects are cumulative. The effects on these organs that I'm describing and that the German pathologists are finding, pathology to your aorta, pathology to your spleen, your kidneys, and your brain. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And the stringy clots that are created and the people collapse for no observable reason at age 52 or at age 32 or at age 16, hockey players. And they were well, but in the 30 to 60 day window after the shot, they're now very not well. And of course it doesn't affect everyone. Of course not. It's a certain percentage. But one thing's for sure. For every one child that they have saved from COVID, they have severely damaged 100 to 117. The statistics show it's about 100 to 1 ratio of benefit of COVID lessening compared to damage from the vaccine. One other thing with you for sure. This only came out 3 days ago. The PhD scientist was Stephanie Seneff. Her colleague was Kathy Dopp. The publication date is the 13th of February. Oh, pardon me, I misread it. I thought it was the 13th of March. Anyway, it's been out 1 month. And their principal comment at the very end was that mandates of COVID inoculations are ill-advised because the vaccines result in higher death rates than COVID itself.
Way higher. As you said very early on, the numbers of deaths from children are so small that they may not even exist. I mean, there's just very few COVID deaths in children.
From the infection of COVID, but tens and 20s and 30s and 40s, and it adds up into the hundreds and actually thousands of hidden deaths in children throughout the world being caused by their being made to have a forced vaccination.
Yeah. Well, I'm really, really glad that you're here. Let's talk after the show about maybe doing something to get this into a print form, this just amazing review that you just did for us. Christopher Shoemaker, Dr. Shoemaker, thank you, thank you, thank you for being with us today. Thank you so much.